So the next speaker is Kathleen Schubert from the Paris School of Economics about managing future emissions, a theory of commons versus market-based economics.
Thanks a lot for inviting me. I think it's a perfect transition between what I'm going to say and what Sandrine just talked about. I'm going to talk about how all these changes, how can we make all these changes happen? Okay, because the previous speakers have shown how much, how huge the task is to have all these changes that are necessary to reach decarbonation and zero net emissions. But the question is how are we going to do it? And I'm going to talk about that from an economist point of view, maybe a bit, obsessed by the carbon tax. But pardon me, I am an economist, actually. So, okay, so the climate is seen by economists as what we call a global public good. It's a public good, it's not a private good, it's not like that, clearly. It's a public good, and it is global because it is meaningful for everybody, all the world. So in this context, each country's emissions of greenhouse gases contribute cumulatively to the degradation of the climate, and each country's abatement, each country's effort to decrease their emissions entail higher costs than benefits, because the country bears the cost and the benefits are for everyone. Okay, so from an individual point of view, there is very little incentive to act. So that's why it's really important that there is a policy, a collective action and policy to fight to fight climate change. And so for economists, the efficient response to this problem is uniform worldwide carbon price. I say carbon, but it's on greenhouse gas price on greenhouse gas emissions. This price must reflect the social cost of these emissions, and if we put in place such a price at the world level, it would entail an equalization of the abatement cost worldwide. And economists show that it is cost efficient in the sense that for any given objective of reduction of emission, doing like that allows to reach the objective at least cost. It is the least costly solution for society as a whole. This is theory, simple theory. However, implementation of this uniform carbon tax clearly is out of reach at the moment, and maybe also forever. So we have to try to understand why, and also, of course, to try to devise other solutions. So why? Because when you think about other public goods like, public lighting, there is a jurisdiction in charge of providing it and paying for it, municipalities, for instance. But for climate, there is no jurisdiction at the world level, which role would be to provide and to pay for it. Okay, no international organization that would be entitled to do that. And so the only way is for country to resort to negotiations. And so they have to talk, okay? They have to negotiate to try to reach a climate agreement. And the climate agreement would be about who is doing what, how to allocate the efforts. And these negotiations, they have started at COP1, 1995, so very, very long time ago. As my students said, when they started, we were not born. Okay, that's for sure. And so they were not born, and we didn't make a lot of progress since. Some progress, I don't want to say no progress, but the success is quite limited, and the tasks proved to be extraordinarily difficult. So some points about why it is so difficult to reach a global agreement on the climate. It's very difficult because there are strong free-riding incentives, what economists call free-riding. What is free-riding? It is the fact that you prefer that others do the job. Okay, for the climate, if the other country reduces their emissions, you are not incited to do the same because it's going to be good for climate and cost nothing for you. So this is free-riding, and it is very, very, probably very, very strong in this matter. Also, there is a temporal dimension of the problem. It's not just a static problem, static stuff that you can solve now. It's temporal. Emissions of the past are still determining the state of the climate today. And what we emit today will last forever, not forever, but for a very, very long time in the atmosphere. And so this temporal dimension complicates the things a lot, because if we do climate policy, we are going to pay the cost. Present generations are going to pay the cost, but the benefits will mainly be for future generations, and they are not here. Less and less so. They are more and more here. 20 years ago, maybe we could say that. Now the young people, they are understanding that they are going to bear the costs, and so they are more here to negotiate. Okay, but nevertheless, the temporal dimension makes things, again, more difficult. Also, there is the question of the different historical responsibilities, that's for sure. In climate change, the developed countries have emitted the big bulk of what is now in the atmosphere. And so they have this historical responsibility, even though they didn't know that it was a problem to do that. Okay, but actually, they did it. And so in the discussion with developing countries, it is very important, because developing countries, they think that they don't have to pay for what industrialized countries have done in the past. But the problem is that now some emerging countries, China, for instance, emit more than developed countries, not per capita, but in absolute terms, levels. And of this is also an issue. And finally, there is a question of the difference in levels of development and the abilities to pay for the problem. Okay, clearly, difference in level of development are a very important point as well. So if you look at the theoretical literature, in the end, what they tell you is that equalizing marginal abatement costs across all the countries in the world with a uniform carbon price, only one carbon price for everyone, is the good solution only if transfers between countries are allowed. Only if it is possible to transfer money between countries, okay? And or if you don't care about distributional issues. But if you care about distributional issues, this is the efficient solution only if transfers are allowed, can be implemented across countries. In the realistic case where transfers between governments are not possible or are too small, then international differentiation of the carbon price is the good solution to take care of equity issues across countries. But again, a new problem. You can differentiate carbon prices, okay, across countries, but how to set the levels of these carbon prices? It becomes very quickly extraordinarily difficult. Then you have another literature I want just to allude on. It's a literature on intergenerational and intragenerational climate justice. And this literature discusses the principle that could guide the fair sharing of the remaining carbon budget and of the abatement effort that we have to do, fair sharing between generations and also between countries. And no real consensus emerges. We would like to see the good solution. What would be the right way to implement transfers across countries to allocate fairly the burden of fighting against climate change? Would it be, I don't know, rights to emit per capita, or would it be that we have to compensate for historical emissions, historical responsibilities, or other solutions? The literature is not clear on that point, and I think there is still a lot to do here. So to sum up on that, at the world level, we are not, it doesn't work very well, okay, climate policy. So countries, they are tempted to resort to unilateral climate policy, domestic policies. And this is what I want to talk a bit now. About Europe, to take an example, so unilateral policies, they also have their issues, clearly. For instance, in Europe, what we can see in the surveys and so on is that Europeans are not climate skeptics. They think climate change is an important issue. They think we have something to do. We must do something. They are willing to take actions, individual actions, like separating waste and so on. But they don't want, they are strongly opposed to policies like carbon pricing. Okay, and they don't like carbon pricing, on average, of course. They consider that it is just another tax. They have the doubts about the fact that it is actually an efficient tax for climate. They think it's just a way of, for the government to take money out of them. They consider that it is unfair, and it's right, because it is actually a regressive tax. I'm going to talk a bit about that in a minute. And also they consider that it limits their freedom. They like driving their cars, okay? I simplify, but okay. People, they tend to prefer subsidies, of course, but also command and controls policies like standards, like norms, which impose an implicit rather than an explicit price on carbon emissions. Just a parenthesis of about why do they prefer standards and subsidies. I'm not sure, but some elements would be that in spite of the fact that standards are most costly and generally more regressive than carbon pricing for a given environmental result, their effectiveness is more apparent. Okay, it's clear that a standard, it's clear that it limits emissions. Also, their cost is less salient. You don't see the cost. When there is standards on vehicles, on cars, you don't see the increase of the price of the car that is due to these standards. Also, they apply to everyone alike. This is very important. They apply to everyone alike, so this is more equitable in some sense, because for taxation, people think, okay, poor people are going to be constrained by taxation. Rich people, they are just going to pay, and it's okay. Okay. Then subsidies. Subsidies, they benefit mainly rich people. However, they are preferred to carbon pricing, probably because there is a bad understanding about general equilibrium effects, meaning that when there is a subsidy, it has to be financed somewhere. So you have to take another tax somewhere else, and people don't get that. And also, there is a bias in favor of a positive policy like a subsidy rather than a negative one like a tax. So how can we increase public support to carbon pricing? I don't want to say that carbon pricing is the only way to do. I agree with you that we need to do a lot of other things, but I am very much persuaded that it is a necessary thing to do. Without it, we are not going to make it, clearly. Okay. And so how to increase support? So there are the individual factors for which people don't like carbon pricing. And for instance, personal outcome expectancy in terms of purchasing power, because it's going to be a cost for them. In terms of lifestyle, you don't drive your car anymore. Or for their jobs, simply for their job, or for their job. So here, economists insist a lot on the fact that the good way to do that is to compensate. You take the money, you take the proceeds from the tax receipts, and you redistribute to people. Okay, you compensate for instance, for people that are going to lose their job, or for regressivity issues, and so on. And also, it is very important to highlight co-benefits. Co-benefits in terms of health, but I don't insist on that. We have already talked about it. Then for fairness, also, you have to compensate people. Carbon tax is regressive. It is more negative for the purchasing power of poor people than for rich people. Okay, so you have to compensate the poorest people, clearly, because it is climate policy. It's not a regressive policy. You don't want it to be regressive. Okay, so you have to compensate, like green checks or transfers and so on. So for freedom, what is very important is public investment in alternatives. If people don't have any alternatives, you can tax them as you wish. They are not going to change their behavior, okay? So you have to provide alternatives, and we have already talked about that for transport, for instance. And then effectiveness. You have to persuade people that a carbon tax is actually effective, that it works, by giving information and explaining that it is just another tax. Then there are the contextual social factors that make people reluctant, more like history, political culture, social norms, also the quality of government. The fact, for instance, in France that people are very don't believe what the government say. They don't. There is no trust actually in the government. So all that is these contextual social factors. They are first country specific. It depends on the countries. And also the change is difficult and slow. How do you change a political culture? How do you change social norms? It's a bit of a mystery, okay? It's like sufficiency. Sufficiency, it's good, but how do you make it happen? So this is a very important, of course, area for research and for us to say things. And then there is, for this contextual social factor, the question very important of transparency. The government has to be very transparent about what it does and try to construct a collective project to embark society in the project. It's easier to say than to be done, okay? 2 minutes? Yeah, 3 minutes, it's perfect. So, I just want to finish on a few other elements, like the spatial, sectoral, and international dimensions. The spatial dimension, it's important to recognize that there are within countries issues, people in rural, suburban, or urban area, they are not affected the same by climate policy, by carbon pricing. There is a big divide, rural and urban, clearly because of the equipments they have, because rural households, they don't have access to public transport, and so on. So this is clear, but it has to be taken into account when the government devises compensation for the carbon pricing, it is important. There is also the question of different European countries. Think of Poland, for instance. You cannot think of climate policy the same when you are French or when we are Polish, because coal is very, very important in the Polish economy and so on. So there are what we call brown communities, not just in Poland, but a bit everywhere, people who would be very much affected by climate policy because this is how they make their living. And so there is a need to take special attention to that, of course, with dedicated compensation. In Europe, there is this Just Transition Fund that has been that will be put in place for this kind of purpose. Also, there is sectoral dimensions. There are sectors that are going just to disappear, hopefully. and others are going to appear, but it's difficult to reallocate activity. It's not the same people, maybe, that are able to work. You cannot take a coal miner and tell him, okay, now you are going to insulate dwellings, okay? So there is a lot of things to do for that, to reallocate allocation and employment and people from fossil intensive industry to green activities. And it has to be planned. It has to be, there is a need of thinking of that, of course. And then there is the international dimension in the context of asymmetric climate policy. As I said at the beginning, a world climate policy, unified, uniform, seems difficult to put in place at the moment. So climate policy, they are asymmetric. Europe is an advanced country on that part. And so the European industry, intensive in energy, makes big lobbying to try to prevent as much as possible ambitious climate policy, clearly. Okay, and they say it's bad for our competitiveness. We are losing market shares at home and abroad. And so we have to take care of that. In Europe now, they are very close to putting in place what is called a carbon border adjustment mechanism. It's a mechanism that makes it, that prevents carbon leakage, and that can raise acceptance for climate policy from part of the industry. So it's a mechanism that makes exporters pay for the carbon they. So no, importers pay for the carbon of their products. And this kind of mechanism also maybe for economists has the potential to incentivize countries to form like carbon clubs, countries that would have a high ambition, high climate policy ambition, and would group together inside carbon clubs where this climate policy could develop and could be ambitious. Okay, so I stop here. Thank you very much.